So when I emailed Jamie and said, so you're reading this Sunday, I'm going to give you some passages you're not going to hear in church too often. Like Song of Songs is just not something that you hear. It's essentially a love poem. And it's, this is like the PG part. There's certainly some more sort of sexual parts, right? This is certainly romantic love. It's beautifully written, right? It's this beautiful ancient poem about two people who really love each other. And I don't know why we don't read that in church. I don't know why we don't ever talk about that, right? It's a beautiful thing. Like I said, we're going to be talking about gluttony today, a little bit of gluttony, a little bit of lust. I think we can do both, in part because we're talking about food and sex, and these are two things that are very bodily. There's a lot of similarities between what makes each healthy and what makes each unhealthy. And so I think we can do this in one sermon. Part of the issue is the desire for really fatty foods and the strong desire for sex and sexuality are totally human and really adaptive in their early environments. So if you think about early humans, there wasn't a lot of food. So you had to have strong desires to get fatty meats that are going to last you a long time, right? Because you don't know when the next time you're going to kill a mastodon or whatever is, right? So you got to figure out what that's like. So you have a strong desire to do this because if you didn't have that, your ancestors wouldn't have survived. Well, the same thing when you have a very limited population. Having lots of babies, like you read the Bible, you got to have children just to survive, just to work the land, right? This is an important thing. You got married when you were 13, 14 years old. So we have these very natural desires, but you put it in a 21st century context, it's no longer adaptive, it's now maladaptive. Now, I'm a human being who desperately wants sugary and fatty foods that's surrounded by food everywhere I go. So now, it makes it really difficult. But it gives me hope in some ways, like, it's not a mistake. These desires are not because Joe Bankard is awful, it's because I'm human. This is what humans want. It's why vegetables look gross, at least to 99.9% of us. Right? You can eat berries all day long and you're still hungry, right? And that doesn't help us when we're trying to live 10,000 years ago. And so in the modern context, it's awful. Well, the same thing now. We got overpopulation. We were trying to control the number of kids we have. We're waiting until we're 30 till we get married. Oh, and introduce like magazines on every rack in the grocery store and the internet and pornography and all kinds of other things. And what was once a very natural, adaptive thing in a current environment, right, where you're getting married young and having lots of kids, now suddenly it's a horrible, maladaptive desire that's so difficult to control. But it's not because Joe Bankard is bad, it's because I'm human. The issue is to like acknowledge this in some way. These are good gifts. Food is a good gift from God. And sex is a good gift from God. It's a beautiful, wonderful thing. I should enjoy tasting food. It's not an accident that dopamine is released in my brain when I eat certain foods. It gives me pleasure, literally, like, oh yes. That's not an accident, that's a good thing, right? Sexuality, good thing, gift. So we have to celebrate it, and at the same time, our 21st century culture makes these things so difficult to not have them rage entirely out of control. So part of it is figuring out what's the purpose, right? Like food is here to nourish my body and food is here to be enjoyed. But often that easily gets twisted into food is here to try to fill a spiritual void, an emotional void, a relational void. And so I will eat to try and generate that feeling of goodness, that dopamine, right? It's a way of numbing out, right? And so food then becomes a crutch. It becomes something that I have this unhealthy relationship to. And sexuality is here for intimacy. It's about vulnerability. It's about like mutual self-giving, right? Where we're coming together in a vulnerable and intimate way. It's about love. And pleasure is a part of it, but it easily gets twisted into possessiveness and ownership. And my desire is what ultimately matters. And I think a lot of it is like the consumeristic mentality that we experience. We're supposed to be consumers. And consumerism is so interesting because consumerism brings with it the illusion that I'm in control. Right? Like, as long as I'm the one doing the choosing, I decide what I'm going to eat and when I'm going to eat, right? As long as, then it's like a kind of possessiveness, an ownership, a consumption of food or the other that gets so unhealthy. It's not about healthy relationship anymore. It's not about nutrition, enjoyment, love, or intimacy. It's about, what am I getting out of it? Like a good consumer. What is this doing for me? I don't have enough of it. I should have more of it. So what would it look like to try and have a healthy relationship with this, right? One of the things that Paul mentions in the Corinthians passage, the key question, right? Do I control my desires or do my desires control me? This is Paul, I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is going to be beneficial for me. It's like, I can do stuff, but should I? I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. Like, how controlled am I? And then after this he says, you know, food for the stomach for food, which is it? Which is being mastered? Who has control? And then he goes from that into sexuality. And do I have control over my desires, or do my desires have control over me? The illusion, I think, of the consumeristic world we live in is that as long as I'm the one doing the deciding, the consenting, the purchasing, the eating, then I'm in control. But we're kidding ourselves if we think that's true. I can be the one doing the choosing and the desiring and the consuming and actually have no control over my desires. I'm being ruled by them. So I want to look at gluttony first. Right? They're connected, but I want to talk about gluttony first. And ultimately, this is not about what you weigh. This is about your relationship to food. This is about why do you eat, when you do, and how you do. What's motivating it? And I think gluttony shows itself in one of two ways. One, we're overly controlled, right? We're overly controlled, but we're thinking about food all day long. But trust me, when it comes down to it, I'm going to be picky, my portions will be small, but it's got to be in a particular, it's like very fastidious, it's very precise, right? But food still has the upper hand because my relationship to it is one where I have to be overly controlled. C.S. Lewis talks about this actually in his book Screwtape Letters. It's a great book. C.S. Lewis writes where you have two demons that are having this conversation in letters, and they're each talking about how they're tempting humans to fall into patterns of anger or unforgiveness or gluttony or whatever. So Screwtape is talking about this other demon, Glubos, who's got this woman in the pattern of gluttony, but it's not because she's just eating whatever she wants. It's different, right? She would be astonished to learn that her whole life is enslaved to this kind of sensuality, which is quite conceded from her by the fact that the quantities involved are small. But what do quantities matter, provided we can use a human belly and palate to produce querulousness, impatience, uncharitableness, and self-concern? Glubos has this old woman well in hand. She is a positive terror to hostesses and servants. She is always turning from what she has been offered her to say with a demure little sign and a smile, "Oh, please, please, all I want is a cup of tea, weak but not too weak, and the teeniest, weeniest bit of really crisp toast." This is in Britain, so that would make sense. You see, because what she wants is smaller and less costly than what has been set before her, she never recognizes as gluttony her determination to get what she wants, however troublesome it may be to others. The real value of the quiet, unobtrusive work which Glubos has been doing for years on this old woman can be gauged by the way in which her belly now dominates her whole life. To be overly picky in such a way that it's rude, breaks relationship, is uncharitable, unkind, overly controlled, but thinking about it all the time. Of course, the other is the one where I'm eating and I don't even know why I am. Like, what's the real cause of this? What am I trying to fill? Rebecca DeYoung, the author of Glittering Vices, says, you know, we raid the cupboards because we're trying to fill a spiritual or emotional hole in our lives. But until we understand why we're doing it, until we recognize what's driving me in this way, it's really hard to stop, because what it looks like is like a diet, and that's not what we need. Like, well, maybe if I just ate less food, maybe if I just lost a little bit of weight, maybe I could just get in on top of this thing. But the food is the symptom, it's not the problem. It's just the symptom. It's the same with lust. It's the same with pornography. Those are just symptoms of what's in us that drives us to the behavior. There's a very interesting book. It's been highly recommended to me. Women, Food, and God. And there's a lot to unpack, but it's a lot about a kind of spiritual and emotional journey. But the ways in which unhealthy relationships to food emerge as a result of this. Here are a few quotes that I think are the most impactful, at least for me. People turn to food when they are not hungry because they are hungry for something they can't name, a connection to what is beyond the concerns of daily life, something deathless, something sacred. But replacing the hunger for divine connection with double-stuffed Oreos is like giving a glass of sand to a person dying of thirst. It creates more thirst, more panic, and maybe all addiction, all obsession is like this. I tell them that if compulsive eating is anything, it is a way we leave ourselves when life gets hard, when we don't want to notice what's going on. Compulsive eating is a way we distance ourselves from the way things are when they are not how we want them to be. Next one. Compulsive eating is basically a refusal to be fully alive. No matter what we weigh, those of us who are compulsive eaters have anorexia of the soul. We refuse to take in what sustains us. We live lives of deprivation. And when we can't stand it any longer, we binge. The way we are able to accomplish all of this is by the simple act of bolting, of running, of leaving ourselves hundreds of times every day. And what's hard is it works. Food is so comforting. It's like a wonderful little hug. The vices are glittering because they give us what we want in the short term, and they leave us emptier and broken in the long term. Who controls what? Until I know what I'm trying to fill, I don't know that I'll ever have a sense of my desires and what drives me when it comes to food, or alcohol, or lust. So I want to talk a little bit about lust, and then I want to look at some ways we might remedy or at least work to get healthy. Lust, one of my favorite quotes from the De Young text comes from, she quotes Frederick Buechner, "Sex is sinful to the degree that instead of drawing you closer to the other human beings in their humanness, it unites bodies but leaves the lives inside them hungrier and more alone than before." It's a kind of possessiveness, a desiring that unites bodies but leaves us ultimately more isolated and more alone. And I think that can be true as much when you're married as when you are single. That sex is used for things other than intimacy or love or vulnerability. It becomes something I feel insecure, I feel insignificant, I feel alone, and this makes me at least temporarily feel attractive, okay, filled in some way. That doesn't work long term. So how do we transition our sexual lives in such a way that we use them to unite human beings rather than to divide human beings? And again, it's very difficult when the culture I live in wants it to be about performance and wants it to be about mere pleasure, wants it to be something other than a kind of vulnerable intimacy, something that makes me feel connected and united to the person that I love. So Song of Songs has this great poem, right, where you have these two people who really love each other, and sex becomes an appropriate way of expressing that. But how often that gets twisted, where, again, I don't have any sense of my desires, they sort of control me. Lead me astray. Lead me into isolation. So what would it look like to start to transition, right, to become somewhat different in the way we engage these topics? One thing I think is that church just needs to talk about them, so this is a start. And we need to talk about them with our children. We need to be able to have conversations about things that are uncomfortable. No one wants to talk about how much money we make. No one wants to really talk about sex, and no one really wants to talk about food, but they're real issues, right? You're not alone. We're in a whole room of people who struggle and who are human. So that might be a start. Rebecca DeYoung says this. She says, the first thing you might want to consider doing is just try to fast from this stuff. Just try to fast. Lent is about fasting, and historically it was about food. Take some things out of your life. She says the goal is not to have willpower to like change who you are through your own brute strength, because that doesn't work. You fast to recognize how dependent you are on this stuff, how much it controls you. You fast so you can see how hard it is to give things up. And that might be, again, fasting from food, from social media. It might mean getting filters on our computer. It might mean all kinds of things to try and help us as we abstain. How controlled am I? But once I recognize that, she says, just acknowledge, throw your hands up and say, it's got me. Just say it. This stuff has got me. This addiction, this obsession, this way of eating, this pattern of avoiding, of numbing, of running has got me. And by waving the white flag, it's like a way of taking back some strength. It's like an honesty. I fast to figure out what controls me, and then I acknowledge that it controls me. But do you know how few people even have that awareness? This controls me? Why does it control me? What emotional or spiritual void am I filling? And then she says, we need each other. So after all of this, and we throw up the white flag, if you think your life will be different because of willpower, it won't. What would it look like to put structures in your life to make change? Structural changes to help guide the way we connect with each other sexually, to the way in which we eat, the way in which we're drawn to food. What would it be like to be in small groups of people who we could actually share these struggles with and have accountability and support and prayer? You doing it alone, pretending it's not a problem, thinking you'll fix it tomorrow will be different. These are all delusions. I think instead we become aware of what controls us and why it controls us. We throw up the white flag and then we look for help. We say help. Anyone else, right, with me? And the more support we find, the more we change. The more support and love we find from other people, the less I need this stuff. The less holes I'm trying to fill with it. So you are not alone. We are in this together. And with God's grace, we might take baby steps to change. So let's pray. Lord, we are so often dominated and controlled by our bellies and our bodies in ways we don't like to admit or acknowledge. Help us to raise the white flag, to admit we've been bested, to call upon your grace, which is so abundant, and then find strength in each other, that we might heal, that we might forgive, and that we might grow. Amen. If you would please stand for our closing song.